I hear the traffic is kind of and stuff, so people will trickle in. Welcome to the Young Association of Western Mass. And I want to thank Smith. We're back in, I feel like this is our home. Who went last time to Hilliard Hall and saw the Marian Woodman film? It was quite amazing. But I feel like this room is our little home. It's really cozy. And I want to thank Judy Hall. Thank you. I don't have a microphone, so I'll have to. Judy Hall is our editor, and Dan Grunwald is our amazing webmaster. And Carol Beauvais over there is our community diva. And Thayer Green is our Jungian analyst advisor. And where's Penny? Penny is also Penny Tarasak. And I'm the president, so welcome. We would really encourage you, if you have not, to sign our email list. If you'd like to get emails, we can send them out just twice a month. We don't bother you. We just send you what's happening. And also, it's westmassyoung.org is our website, which Dan has designed and keeps up. So please help us with our organization and give us $10 if you possibly can in our donation baskets, because we do need money to bring in people like Steve Bond from Boston. So tonight we don't take a bathroom break, but there is a bathroom right out here. It says it's for guys, but don't worry about it. It's a Smith, so it doesn't matter. And we are going to record tonight. We have an archive, so you can go on our website and you can listen to past lectures. And if we're recording and you're asking something that you don't want to have recorded, just say, please stop the recording, and we'll do that to honor your confidentiality. Okay, we have a number of things going on. Before the next lecture, October 21st, is a workshop that we're sponsoring, Active Imagination, listening to our inner stories. And I'm actually the one who's giving it. So, and it's going to be at the Arts and Industry Building. Active Imagination was Jung's main way of working when he really discovered it. And it's an experiential workshop. You don't have to know anything. In fact, the less you know, probably the more open you are to what might happen. And it's very safe. I make sure that we don't project and analyze each other's stuff. So it's an experience of connecting with the unconscious. So with all the lectures and workshops, I would really appreciate people from the hill towns and people that where we can't get stuff, if you would grab a couple of flyers and put them up on a bulletin board somewhere, because we can't get around. There's such a vast little network of wonderful towns around here. So grab a couple of flyers of that. There's this one, and there's another little one. If I run out. Next is... our next lecture is Penny Tarasak, talking on dreams. She's a local analyst. Accepting Psyche's Gift, the Dream. It's a lecture on Monday night, first night.
Friday night.
Why did I say Monday? I wonder what that myth is. Okay, so Monday night.
Friday.
I'm coming on Monday night, okay? Yes. Okay, here's a little flyer to go out for that. Okay. I also have just a few brochures, the new brochures for the Jung Institute of Boston, their public programs. And I just have a couple, but if you really want one, or you can go to their website and get information. And this information always, we put it out when it's appropriate for you guys, so you don't have to go there unless you want to really look at it. There's also the Connecticut Association in Hartford for Jungian Psychology, and I just want to mention, tomorrow they are starting, they have this ongoing seminar of Jung's works. They're starting maybe their second, third year of ION. It's really a wonderful group. So if you really want to do some serious studying, it's every Saturday mornings, not every Saturday mornings, in West Hartford. They have a seminar, and it's in here. And I think we have it on the, we put it on the website at one point, right? We did. One point. Okay. So this, the next workshop is the 24th, Saturday, the 24th, from 10 to 4. All right. And after this, please come and join us at the Mosaic Cafe for a salon where we'll just have an informal talk and we can talk more about the subject or whatever we want to talk about Jung. And it's the Mosaic, everybody know where the Mosaic restaurant is? It's on Masonic Street. So we gather there afterwards. Okay, I will put these over here so you can get them. And, and there's one more thing I want to talk about briefly. The Jung Institute, they train analysts there. It's in Newton. They also have an auditors program, so you don't have to be training. You can be of another profession and with a master's degree, and you can go and you can study and take the first stage of courses. So you can apply as an auditor. And then you can decide to be candidate or not be a candidate. So we wanted to open up the knowledge of Jung. I'm on the training board. We wanted to open up to more people. So if you're interested in it, there's a little flyer here. Or talk to one of the analysts, me, Steve, Thayer, Penny. Yes?
You need to mention that one of the requirements, even for being an auditor, is a fair number of hours of Jungian analysis.
Right. Part of the basis of Jungian work is the actual experience of it. We can think about it all we want, but it's really the experience of it that makes it really is part of the studying of it. So whether you train to be an analyst or you're an auditor, you have to have some analysis first and continue to. Okay, so tonight we have David Stephenson Bond.
Steve is fine.
Steve Bond from Boston. He's a Jungian analyst in Boston. And he's speaking about the living myth, personal meaning as a way of life. And is your book still in print?
It is.
It is.
Thank
wow.
you so much.
That's
great.
Amazing.
After 23 years.
Yeah, it's pretty hard to keep things in print. So it's called The Living Myth. It was published in 1993. That was your first publication, right?
Actually, my second. But you wouldn't be interested in the first.
Oh, is that the one you wrote when you were 12?
Yeah, that one.
His first novel he wrote when he was 12. Isn't that amazing? And it's published?
No.
Oh, okay.
Only in my mind.
Okay. And and then you wrote Healing Lily.
Healing Lily's 2010.
2010.
Yeah. And that is published. Yeah.
And My Stranger, 2012.
Yeah.
And now he's working on a Dan Brown kind of novel called The Clandestine Catalyst. He's obviously good with words. So stay tuned for that. That will be published soon, hopefully.
A couple years?
Okay. Also, another interesting thing about Steve is that from 1995 to 1999, he was the founder and president of OnlinePsych.com, which was the largest mental health site on the internet at the time. So let's welcome Stephen Bond.
Did anybody ever go to OnlinePsych.com? 1995, 96, 97, 98, 99? Did anybody here on America Online at that time? Anybody AOL people, right? The mental health information you saw in AOL, that was us. We provided all the mental health information for America Online. That was back in another time, wasn't it? The .com, before the .com crash. So I want to thank the executive committee for inviting me to be here tonight. I find this a really interesting opportunity for me to discuss a topic that Yes, if you look at the calendar, I've been preoccupied with for the last 25 years, which is hard to believe that it's been that long, but it has. I was writing Living Myth 25 years ago. And the topic that really grasped me at the time was this idea of a personal myth. Which, as far as I know, and we could do some research to find out, Jung invented the term personal myth. There have been some other ways of talking about it. Sure enough, Otto Rank talked about the need for the genius personality to develop an individual ideology. That's what Otto Rank, the Freudian, called it. And that was in his book, Truth and Reality, first published in 1929, and I think surely Jung had read Otto Rank and would be familiar with that kind of thinking. But I think the term personal myth is a far more elegant term than individual ideology. And for me personally, and perhaps for most of the people in this room, the very first time you would ever have come across that term, personal myth, is in the prologue of Jung's autobiography, Memories, Dreams, Reflections. That's where it comes for the very first time, on page 3. Right? My life is a story of the self-realization of the unconscious. Everything in the unconscious seeks outward manifestation. And the personality, too, desires to evolve out of its unconscious conditions and to experience itself as a whole. I cannot employ the language of science to trace this process of growth in myself. Think, do you want to write an autobiography? And what would that be like? For I cannot experience myself as a scientific problem. What we are to our inward vision and what man appears to be, subspecies eternitatis, can only be expressed by way of myth. Myth is more individual and expresses life more precisely than does science. Science works with concepts of averages that are far too general to do justice to the subjective variety of individual life. Every word is golden here to me. Thus, it is that I have now undertaken in my 83rd year to tell my personal myth. I can only make direct statements, only tell stories. Whether or not the stories are true is not the problem. The only question is whether what I tell is my fable, my myth. How many have read Memories, Dreams, Reflections? You know, and if you have not, it needs to be on your list. I have to say that reading MDR, that's what we're going to call Memories, Dreams, Reflections from here on, changed my life. And so, these years later, funny how a single book can so totally and utterly alter the course of one's development. I was in the third and the final year, my final semester, at Vanderbilt Divinity School in the spring of 1981. And that would be, where's Vanderbilt? Nashville, Tennessee. Great place to live. I was already well on my way to my PhD in religion and psychology. My major professor, Peggy Way, at the time, had suggested that I take a course over in the graduate school, the psychological department, about the course, The Development of Self in C.G. Jung. And perhaps you may have had an experience like this, even around this campus or things like that. I, for one, like to stay in the safe little world of our DDS building. And so I grumbled and complained about the idea of having to travel all the way across campus to some other building I had never seen before. But she talked me into it. I showed up for the first day of class and was surprised to learn that the professor was a Freudian analyst who was teaching this course on Jung at Vanderbilt. The syllabus, the very first thing was MDR. That was the first book we were supposed to read in this course. And I soon settled down to start reading that book. I started reading at 4 in the afternoon. At 2 in the morning, I was still reading. 200 pages in the NDR. And at that hour, 2 in the morning, I had just finished reading chapter 6. You know what chapter 6 is? Which Jung calls confrontation with the unconscious. As you may remember, that chapter is the story of Jung's descent into the unconscious after his break with Freud in 1912, and about the collapse of the Victorian era that we call World War I, and also his visions and dialogues that we know today from the publication of the Red Book. That's what chapter 6 is in MDR. Reading that chapter put me into such a state of excitement that I needed to put the book down and stop at 2 in the morning. I knew that I needed to go to sleep, but I wondered how I could possibly sleep after what I had just experienced. So, closing my eyes, I remember having the thought, completely spontaneously, that I was going to have a significant dream. A thought which I found a little unnerving. This is the dream that I had that night. I dream that I am asleep in my bed. Suddenly I hear the television come on in the living room. I know it is deep into the night, and I think to myself, I have certainly turned the television off. I realize there is an intruder in the house. Someone has broken in. I'm panicked, but will myself to find the courage to get up out of bed and confront the intruder. I get up, peer around the bedroom door, and sure enough, the television is on. I burst into the living room, but no one is there. Then I hear a noise in the kitchen and go to the back door. When I come into the kitchen, I am astonished to find the back door is gone. The entire outside wall has been blown away and is open to the weather. When I go to the wall, the wind is blowing, and a warm summer rain is falling on my face. So, there is much that could be said about that dream. But suffice it to say that Jung, my intruder, had entered my psyche through the back door and blown something open in me. And a warm summer rain in a dream is a good omen, suggesting insemination and fertility. So very soon after this experience, I began to have the fantasy that I wanted to be a psychoanalyst. And looking back these years later, it strikes me that this was a very strange fantasy for a young person to develop in that situation. I had never met a Jungian. I had never met an analyst other than the professor I had just met that same day. I had never been in psychotherapy of any kind. I was 24 years old, soon to be ordained as a minister, off to serve a congregation for a few years so that I could bring a little real-world experience to my PhD thesis, because they like that, back at Vanderbilt, and began my imagined life as a college professor. And the thought of being an analyst had never crossed my mind until that moment. But it was a very powerful fantasy. I managed to put it aside for 6 years, working at a working class congregation in Indianapolis, and have 2 children, and earn a full scholarship for my PhD back at Vanderbilt. So the fantasy of becoming an analyst ruined everything, you could say. I never served the church again. I never earned that PhD or became a college professor. In the end, I lost my faith, such as it was, and wandered far from my former preoccupation with theology and biblical studies, and began to see the myth of Christianity for what it was. And of course, not only Christianity, but Buddhism, Judaism, Confucianism, Islam, Taoism, Mithraism, Any other religious myth you care to name? Jung mentions this moment in his own life, in the very same chapter 6, Confrontation with the Unconscious. Right? Remember this passage? I had explained the myths of people's past. I had written a book about the hero, the myth in which man has always lived. But in what myth does man live nowadays? In the Christian myth, the answer might be, do you live in it? I asked myself. To be honest, the answer was no. For me, it is not what I live by. Then do we no longer have any myth? No, evidently we no longer have any myth. But then what is your myth, the myth in which you do live? At this point in the dialogue with myself, the dialogue with myself became uncomfortable, and I stopped thinking. I had reached a dead end. And remember that Jung was a pastor's child. He grew up in his father's serving a congregation. What is Jung talking about here? You could say, as I have come to phrase it, that the restraining wall of the cultural myth was blown away during the night. Overcome, as Malinowski writes, by those passionate experiences which assail human beings in the impasses of their instinctual life and practical pursuits, in those gaps and breaches left in the ever-imperfect wall of culture which they erect between themselves and the besetting temptations and dangers of destiny. And Jung phrases that very same concept this way, which is something that I thought might be useful to you. Let me get to my page 5. There it is. Since the making of a religion or the formation of symbols is just as important an interest of the primitive mind as the satisfaction of instinct, the way to further development is logically given. Escape from a state of reduction lies in evolving a religion of individual character. The development of individuality is impossible, or at least seriously impeded, if the state of reduction gives rise to forced sublimation in the shape of various cultural activities. He's still somewhat in the Freudian world. These organizations or symptoms are symbola, which enable man to set up a spiritual counterpole to his primitive instinctual nature. And I apologize about the old sexist language. This has been the function of all religions. For a long time, and for the great majority of mankind, the symbol of collective religion will suffice. It is perhaps only temporarily, and for relatively few individuals, that the existing collective religions have become inadequate. Wherever the cultural process is moving forward, we find a shaking off of collective beliefs. Every advance in culture is, psychologically speaking, an extension of consciousness. Therefore, an advance always begins with individuation. That is to say, with the individual, conscious of his isolation, cutting a new path through hitherto untrodden territory. And to do this, he must first return to the fundamental facts of his own being, irrespective of all authority and tradition, and allow himself to become conscious of his distinctiveness. If he succeeds in giving collective validity to his widened consciousness, he creates a tension of opposites that provides the stimulation which culture needs for its further progress. I wanted to read that to you because I'm not really sure, even though you may have come across this in Volume 8. By the way, this is in the article on psychic energy. I have never heard of the idea of evolving a religion of individual character. And that's what Jung is talking about. So, before I continue my story, I thought we should stop for a minute to understand what Jung is saying about the development of the personal myth and individuation. Because that is part of the story. So once again, let me thank you for the opportunity today to be here to talk about personal myth, because as I suspected when I accepted your kind invitation, it gave me the opportunity to review my thoughts on a book I wrote 25 years ago. And I have to say that at this time in my life, it feels as if another person wrote that book. I do. I read it again just for you. Hadn't read it in maybe 10 years. I feel the continuity of it when I read it, in the way that I live my life now, but also honestly feel the discontinuity of the many things I no longer believe and the new thoughts that have arisen since that took place back then. So partly I want to use tonight as an opportunity to reflect a little bit on the things which have surprised me about the way that the concepts I outlined in the book have been taken up by other people. And I must say, even several essential thoughts that I thought were adequately addressed in the book, only to find that as a result of my humble skills as the writer, apparently are consistently misunderstood and overlooked. And I want to come back because they're really, really important points. And that's why every time I read this quote from Jung about collective religion and individuation, I'm reminded of the depth of Jung's thought. Because it seems to me that Jung means one cannot understand the true meaning of individuation without seeing individuation in the context of the birth and the death and the rise and eventual fall of the cultural myth. You can't understand individuation until you understand the cultural situation out of which it arises. How so? So let's start with this. In the book, I point out that this term, personal myth, is a classic oxymoron, of course. By definition, myth is a cultural artifact. Without the cultural piece, it is not a myth. It's a personal delusion, or a fantasy, or an individual ideology, as Otto Rank suggested, or a philosophy, or a guiding principle, or a worldview. But it's not a personal myth. Hence, there is not a personal myth as long as a culture is doing its job and communicating the myth of how to live a life purposefully and meaningfully. Right? As long as the culture is doing its job, you don't need to slough off the cultural myth. It works. And I understand that nowadays, in the life cycle of where we are in the Western myth, it may be very difficult to imagine what it must be like to live in a culture that is fully functional. Our culture is at the end stage of the life cycle of myth, the stage of cultural collapse. So we cannot understand what it must be like to live in a different era, to live in a culture where everything works. And if you just do what the culture tells you to do, your life will give you a sense of satisfaction and achievement. But those are not the times in which we live. So with that background, I want you to hear that quote from Jung again. These organizations or systems are symbola, which enable man to set up a spiritual counterpole to his primitive instinctual nature, a cultural attitude as opposed to sheer instinctuality. This has been the function of all religions. For a long time, and for the great majority of mankind, this symbol of collective religions will suffice. It is perhaps only temporarily and for relatively few individuals that the existing collective religions have become inadequate. And there's a deeper quote that is a little startling that really gets at this. And I want to put just this other one on the table too. This is from Psychology and Alchemy, the opening pages. The central ideas of Christianity are rooted in Gnostic philosophy, which isn't really true, but that's okay. Which, in accordance with psychological laws, simply had to grow up at a time when the classical religions had become obsolete. It was founded on the perception of symbols thrown up by the unconscious individuation process, which always sets in when the collective dominance of human life fall into decay. At such a time, there are bound to be a considerable number of individuals who are possessed by archetypes of a numinous nature that force their way to the surface in order to form a new dominant. Insofar as the archetypal content of the Christian drama was able to give satisfying expression to the uneasy and clamorous unconscious of the many, the consensus omnium raised this drama to a universally binding principle. Not, of course, by an act of judgment, but by the irrational fact of possession, which is far more effective. That Jesus became the tutelary image or amulet against the archetypal powers that threatened to possess everyone. The glad tidings announced, it has happened, but it will not happen to you, insomuch as you believe in Jesus Christ, the Son of God. This is the real quote. Yet it could, and it can, and it will happen to everyone for whom the Christian dominant has decayed, speaking as a Christian. For this reason, there have always been people who, not satisfied with the dominance of cult conscious life, set forth under cover and by devious paths to their destruction or salvation to seek direct experience of eternal roots and, following the lure of the restless unconscious psyche, find themselves in the wilderness. How can we talk about individuation without seeing the cultural context in which all this comes? And Jung is very clear. Which means that if you go sort of deeply into this material, you will discover there's an unresolved theoretical conflict in Jung's several definitions of individuation. And it's at least the two that I want you to think about. Right? On the one hand, in certain passages, Jung clearly has the idea that individuation is a natural, organic process, right? Everyone feels the urge to individuation as naturally as the acorn grows into the oak tree. The DNA unfolds, often frustrated by conflicts in the environment, but in the end, the oak becomes the oak, as it must. That's individuation. On the other hand, in certain passages, such as these two that I have wanted you to read so closely tonight, Jung states that individuation is a problem, shall we say, of only the few, the exceptional, those myth-breaking personalities, not satisfied with the dominance of conscious life, who set forth under cover and by devious paths to their destruction or salvation to seek direct experience of the eternal roots and find themselves in the wilderness. I thought I was a novelist. It's a pretty good sentence.
Could you repeat
that? Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Slow. The italicized part, right? For this reason, there have always been, the reason being the decay of the conscious dominant, the cultural myth. For this reason, there have always been people who, not satisfied with the dominance of conscious life, set forth undercover and by devious paths to their destruction or salvation. We don't know when we start on the path. To seek direct experience, like the Red Book, like active imagination, direct experience of eternal roots, and following the lure of the restless unconscious psyche, find themselves in the wilderness, outside of the walls of culture. So there's this little sort of theoretical conflict. But to me, I think this dilemma of seeing individuation for what it is helps us understand where we are in our culture today. And that is the mythological failure of a culture to create meaning and purpose in the lifestyle of an individual. The wreck of a great ship, if you will. The sinking of the Titanic. The loss of some 90% of the souls on board clinging to that sinking ship for dear life. The few who survive are thrown upon an angry sea with nothing but their own wits and instinct and sheer luck to survive. Individuation is not an ego decision, right? No one ever plans to go there willingly. It can only be imposed on individuation can only be imposed on a person by force of sheer survival instinct. The necessity of developing your personal is not a fate that I would wish on anyone. So it might help. I use the following metaphor in living myth. It is an odd thing to fall out of myth, like standing on the shore and looking back in astonishment at the myth from which you've so recently emerged, a beached whale lying in the summer sun. Only yesterday you were in the belly of the whale with no idea how contained you really were, just how much larger the vast sea could really be. Seeing your life now from the outside of the myth, everything upon which you stood is revalued in an instant. And great sadness, like waves along the sand, washes over the realization that such a living body, such a thing of beauty, should lie in silent rigor, exposed to time and long decay, until the tide should seek the moon and bear away the bones to untold depths. And the rest you can read for yourself. I like the poetry. But we can skip to the last paragraph. But in this twilight of the gods, there are those who hunger for the taste of hunter's meat, who thirst for living water. There are those in the dark night of the eclipse of the collective myths who take the mythological journey into the cave from which all myth is born. Like Lasco, in the firelight where the images of animals dance among the shadows. In such a space, or such a person, in such a situation, excuse me, a personal myth can be born. You know, I don't know if you're in the belly of the whale or on the beach looking at it. So back to my critique that I was talking about, I fail to understand how a person could take this journey into personal mythology as a kind of boredom with their childhood faith. As Jung said, and he said it in many different places, if he found the spark of faith in an analysand, he sent them back into the depths of their own religious tradition. If a person can live within the bounds of his or her own cultural underpinnings, then by all means they should find the resources to do so. You really don't want to find out what life is like outside of the containing walls of culture unless you have no other choice. And this leads me to my second critique, and that is that we are not talking about ideas or fantasies or experimenting. We're talking about finding a way of life that is satisfying. We are talking about personal meaning as a way of life simply because no other way of life is satisfying to your particular personality. A living myth is not a myth until it is practiced in actual living, until it becomes a way of life for someone in particular. And I could find a better way of phrasing it actually, you know, in the book, that a living myth is a lifestyle. And that's the point I was really trying to get across, which seems to me is trying to get at what it's like to live a personal myth at the street level. So much of the time in talking about myth and learning about myths, we're talking about stories. We're talking about the artifacts of culture, right? We know the stories of the Greek gods, but we're only seeing the shell that remains long after the living creature has passed away. A time when the classical religions have become obsolete, as Jung said. You don't really know what it's like to live in those late Bronze Age religions until you immerse yourself in the ritual and the practice of them. Until you attend a wedding, the birth of a child, or worship in a temple with the priests and the mysteries and the oracles. Right? That's what's alive. And that's true whether we're talking about Santeria as practiced in Cuba, right? Or the sun dance of the Hopis in the Taos Pueblo. It's alive at that point. So I guess what frustrates me is when people talk about personal myth as a kind of a retreat workshop or a life hack. I really don't like that term, but okay. I think it has to go deeper to become a participation in symbolic acts. You know, personal ritual that brings tears to your eyes, that calms your anxiety, that changes your mood. When you're cast outside the walls of culture, you're on your own. And Jung's idea is that you are sustained in the wilderness by your own psyche. You don't know what to do. You don't know how to act when you give up on this culture. But psyche shows the way. And Jung was, of course, speaking from his own experience during his own dislocation. Back to confrontation with the unconscious in the Red Book. So I can say, for me, the occasion of my brother's death 6 years ago was one of those moments when I realized just how far outside of the cultural myth I have really traveled. I was raised a Protestant Christian back in West Virginia, and the funeral was at the mortuary where every funeral in my family has always been held. The church where the family gathered for a meal after was the church of my childhood, church my grandparents had been founding members of 100 years before. Excuse me. And for all of the comfort of those circumstances, even in that extreme situation, I could not participate in the Christian ritual. I was physically present, of course, but not participating. There was nothing left for me in that ritual at the time of my greatest need. But I found myself praying to my ancestors, to my grandparents, and to their grandparents. To their grandparents, to receive my brother and to welcome him into the company of ancestors. And that helped. I felt better for that fantasy. And in the months after that, I found myself performing a Shinto ritual, something I discovered in my times in Japan. You know about Shinto and sort of the comfort of the symbolism of a personal family shrine within the household, in a corner, you know, usually with images, and especially with you can light incense. And I could think of my brother, and it helped. I felt better. Something was satisfied. But I could not have known that something like that would ever come out of me. Right? But there it is. So, there's so much more to say about this aspect, this very personal aspect of personal myth, but I think by now you're getting the idea that a living myth is not an intellectual exercise. It is not a personal ideology. It has to be integrated into a lifestyle, into a living practice, and a symbolic life that virtually every single day satisfies the soul, and on the darkest days. And you have to find it for yourself, in yourself. And that's why you don't want to go there unless you have to go there. And my third critique follows from all of this, and that is simply that a myth is not a myth until it is alive to someone in particular. Right? And it means we have to beg the question of how does a symbol come alive? How does it come alive in the culture? How does it come alive in an individual? And if it lives, why does it die? Why does it die in some people but live in other people? You may have thought this just previously in our quote from Jung. Where did Jung get the idea that a myth, a great culture encompassing late Bronze Age religion that lasted for 2,000 years, could over time become obsolete? Isn't that a strange thing to think? But this is the key to the whole thing. What makes a myth come alive is the psychic energy it is able to channel into life and living. In other words, the key to myth is libido and the transformation of libido. And the only way to understand Jung's psychology of religion is to understand Jung's libido theory, which brings us right back to the beginning. Jung's break with Freud in 1912 as the result of the publication of Jung's book Von Lohmann der Libido, which we know today as Volume 5, poorly translated as Symbols of Transformation.
What was the book before it was translated?
The title in German is Von Lohmann der Libido, The Wanderings of Libido.
Oh, okay.
Which is a much better title. Freud and Jung disagreed over the understanding of regression. That's what this libido fight is about. Freud insisted that regression is a disaster, a shattering of the ego fostering a descent into, you know this term in Freud, polymorphous perversity. Right? That's what happened when you regressed. Jung held that in regressing to the primordial psyche, one would find there the myth, the matrix of mythopoetic imagination. It's a little different than polymorphous perversity. So if I can bring this libido discussion down to earth a little bit, think of it in this way. Libido theory is the place where the battle was joined, but it is not the ultimate source of the conflict. The conflict that divided the two men in the end and is at the heart of psychoanalysis to this day. The conflict is about our understanding of the nature of the unconscious. Freud insisted originally that the unconscious is nothing but the repressed content of consciousness. And he later realized he had to give a little ground, so he said that he would recognize that pre-existing in the unconscious is the famous id, which can be called primary process material. Pre-existing, okay. And what does it consist of? Polymorphous perversity. Jung, on the other hand, insisted that the unconscious is none other than the evolutionary functioning of the human species. And you could say that those views reflect the ego attitude of each man. Freud faced the unconscious with an attitude of fear. That's why he saw polymorphous perversity. Jung faced the unconscious with an attitude of trust, which is where he saw our entire instinctual heritage. Now, what does all this have to do with myth? For Jung, what we see as the necessary rise and fall of myths and religions over the course of time is a reflection of the progression and regression of libido in the human psyche. As certain as the tides. So this is The Jung quote. This is, right? This is, again, we're back to on psychic energy. There's, just like the tide, the progression of libido and the regression of libido. And it's the natural movement of the psyche. One of the most important energetic phenomena of psychic life is the progression and regression of libido. Progression can be defined as the daily advance of the process of psychological adaptation. The progression of libido might therefore be said to consist in a continual satisfaction of the demands of environmental conditions. This is possible only by means of an attitude, which as such is necessarily directed and therefore characterized by a certain one-sidedness. Thus, it may easily happen that an attitude can no longer satisfy the demands of adaptation because changes have occurred in environmental conditions which require a different attitude. Does that sound like a religion dying to you? Regression, on the other hand, as the adaptation to the conditions of the inner world, springs from the vital need to satisfy the demands of individuation. I apologize for the sexist language. Man is not a machine in the sense that he can maintain the same output of work. He can meet the demands of outer necessity in an ideal way only if he is adapted to his inner world. That is, if he is in harmony with himself. Conversely, he can adapt to his inner world and achieve harmony with himself when he's adapted to outer conditions. As experience shows, the one or the other function can be neglected only for a time. And so I translated that sort of into a statement about how myth works, right? And then you can see them side by side. A lifestyle might be said to consist of a continual satisfaction of the demands of environmental conditions. This is possible only by means of a myth, which is necessarily cultural and is therefore characterized by certain one-sidedness. Thus, it may easily happen that a myth can no longer satisfy the demands of relatedness because changes have occurred in the environmental conditions which require a different myth. Lifestyle as a functional relationship to the inner world also springs from the vital need to satisfy the demands of individual potential. We are not machines in that we can constantly maintain the same level of social adaptation. We can meet the demands of outer necessity in an ideal way only if we are in a functional relationship adapted to our inner world. That is, if we are in harmony with ourselves. Conversely, we can relate to the inner world and achieve harmony only when we are related to outer conditions. As experience shows, the one or the other function can be neglected for a time. This is a little heavy, but are you getting it? The idea that myth is just in the stories, that there is an evolutionary adaptation of the psyche itself trying to find a pattern that works in a given situation. But as the environment changes, the old pattern no longer works in the new situation. And that this changing environment, it's not only the changing environment in the outer world, it's the changing environment in the inner world and how we adapt to that.
You're saying that the cultural movement changes when the culture no longer suits the environment,
That's what I'm trying to say. In other words, one aspect of the function of myth is environmental. And so that gives us the myths of mountain peoples, like me, the myths of seafaring peoples, of desert peoples, of jungle peoples, right? Not to mention the kind of ritual that emerges when you have to deal with a dangerous volcano in the environment. Like the famous Hawaiian Kapu system, you know, about the Kapu system. That has to do with, unexpectedly, at any minute you could die. How do you manage the anxiety of living in such an environment? Or, to me, the way fundamentalist Christianity works in Tornado Alley in the American Midwest. If you take it far enough, to me, over time, the environmental function of myth becomes expressed as a form of science. Right? Science is the myth of adapting to the environment. Equally important, though, think about it. There are aspects of myth that require us to adapt to the inner environment. The storms blowing through the human psyche are just as dangerous as any tornado. The eruptions of psychic material are as powerful as any volcano. How do we adapt to those conditions? Psyche itself evolves the pattern of relating to psyche. And so, over time, this intrapsychic function of myth, to me, becomes expressed as a form of religion. So this dynamic aspect of libido theory, I think, helps us understand the rise and fall of different myths of different eras. And perhaps it's easy for us to understand how changes in the outer environment force a letting go of the old ways and reward a new adaptation to a new situation. But we need to understand what I find to be the most astounding insight in Jung, and the one essential thing for grasping Jung's psychology of religion, and I think it's what frustrates me in the way that people talk about personal myth. And this is my final point, and that is, Jung is saying the psyche itself is not static. Not ever the same. But the psyche is undergoing changes as dramatic as any climate shift. The psyche itself. That's what Jung is saying. Our species is evolving. The brain is evolving. The psyche itself is evolving. That's what Jung means when he says a religion can become obsolete. The central ideas of Christianity are rooted in Gnostic philosophy, which in accordance with psychological laws, there's the important part, simply had to grow up at a time when the classical religions had become obsolete. He's talking about a change in the psyche that made those late Bronze Age religions obsolete. A change in the psyche. That's what Jung is wrestling with in his often misunderstood book, Answer to Job. And that's his fascination with the myth of the age of Aquarius, right? We're exiting Pisces. We're entering the age of Aquarius. The Platonic months in his book, Aeon. He's struggling to find a myth, a language to describe the evolving character of the psyche itself. Psyche itself is evolving, and our adaptations to those changes is reflected in the history of religion. The most helpful way to understand these intrapsychic changes is not simply to see, as Joseph Campbell or Mircea Eliade see it. When you boil it down, right, what they're saying is that all religions of every time and every place reflect the same basic structure of the collective unconscious, which is ever the same. Jung is saying no. It is not ever the same. That myths have a life cycle. They are born in a time of change and chaos brought about by developments in the psyche itself. That slowly a new pattern of relationship to these changes becomes elaborated and expressed by certain people outside of the walls of the old cultural adaptation. And insofar as this new pattern is functional, it becomes convincing to other people, giving rise to a new religious attitude, which itself shapes a new culture, until such a time as the psyche evolves anew, and the pattern which worked so well in the previous situation fades away, and ultimately it fails for a new era and a new situation. Right? So long as the symbol is a living thing, it is an expression for something which cannot be characterized in any other or better way. The symbol is alive only so long as it is pregnant with meaning. But once its meaning has been borne out, then the symbol is dead. That is, possesses only an historical significance. We may still go on speaking of it as a symbol on the tacit assumption that we are speaking of it as it was before the better expression was born out of it. Right? Substitute the word myth. So long as a myth is a living thing, it is an expression for something which cannot be characterized in any other better way. The myth is alive only in so long as it is pregnant with meaning, but once its meaning is worn out, then the myth is dead, possesses only a historical significance. Use the word religion. So long as a religion is a living thing, it is an expression for something which cannot be characterized in any other better way. The religion is alive only so long as it is pregnant with meaning, but once its meaning has been born out of it, then the religion is dead. That is, possesses only an historical significance. So it has helped me to imagine then the life cycle of myth as, you know, the typical bell curve, right? The new myth is born. It's a personal fantasy in the life of a real and living individual. The psyche shapes it to be functional in relating to the difficult material it's trying to relate to. And as it becomes functional, it becomes convincing. And other people find it and elaborate. And it grows and it grows until it reaches its peak elaboration. And inevitably, by that time, something has changed within the environment. And as people cling to the old way, what was once a functional myth now becomes a dysfunctional myth. And it collapses, returning to the mythopoetic matrix of the psyche from which the new myth will be born. Does that make sense? Or another way that I fantasize about this, this sort of adds the line between cultural orthodoxy and cultural unorthodoxy. Does that make sense? Obviously, the new is born is the unorthodox. And in this, I wanted to contrast a little bit sort of the psyche adapted to the outer environment and the psyche adapting to the inner environment. And perhaps the two cycles cross each other, let's say, so that maybe today we live in a time when our adaptation to the outer environment has reached its peak. When all of the cultural energy has been poured into creating iPhones. But our relationship to the psyche is at its trough. Right? The culture tells us nothing that works anymore. But just, and then over a period of time, of course, our science will decay and decline, and we're already getting there, right? The way we do things to the environment is failing, right? So I think we're a little past peak, actually, right? And perhaps a new way of relating to psyche is emerging. But it is still below the line of cultural orthodoxy. That's one way to look at it, if that makes sense.
Can you give an example of that? This one, this slide here?
The one, the previous?
No, that one, the bell curve.
Okay, that one.
Just give an example so that...
Well, Jung's example is the Platonic myths. You could pick Christianity, you could pick the classical era religions. In Ion, Jung describes Christianity as being born in the time of religious chaos, right? The collapse of the old religions. And it, in the history of religions, that's where he's speaking about Gnosticism, it's true that, and there were many other religious options available, right? The temples of Isis, all of the mystery religions were also very popular, and of course we know that Mithraism, which is kind of a mystery religion, it's literally an underground religion, which is why we couldn't discover that Mithraism existed for thousands of years. But we started digging up the temples, and there you are. There was a literally underground religion that had stages. You advanced, you know, as you learned a new secret, which is the basic Gnostic bit, right? So all of that religious way is still there unconsciously and continues in secret societies, and it's the Masons and things like that. It is just like the mystery and the Isis cults and things like that. But all of this was just at the same time. So somehow, for some sociological reason, Christianity became the religion of the West. Maybe its peak elaboration was the Middle Ages with Augustine, right? In the 13th century. And then it began to not be so functional anymore, right? And then, of course, the Protestant Reformation. I mean, Protestantism is the beginning of the end of Christianity, because you get to just make it up for yourself. Which leads us now to where we are today, at the bottom of another cycle. Does that make sense? Is that an example? Does that work? I mean, like, these are really big things, and I, yeah. Yes?
As you're speaking, I'm thinking that a word you can substitute for religion or myth is a system of rewards. That if you participate in this myth, you get just a system of rewards. There's a hierarchy.
You'll get something.
Right, exactly.
And then you start to see through it and realize, guess what? Welcome to midlife.
Or somebody else.
There's no prize. Work as hard as you want. Be brilliant. Do everything you're told to do. And then you get there and there's no brass ring. Right? That's how you know you've hit midlife. Right. You could also call it a habit of mind, right? I mean, that's a word that clinical psychology is using nowadays, right? Habit of mind, which is it's a myth, but it's the same view. You sort of adopt it unconsciously and live it, but then if you run into trouble, you start finding that it isn't working for you. And you find out that what everybody believes all around you, they say it's working for them, but when you really get into their lives, you see how much it's not really working for them. But they don't know it. But they're unhappy. They're not happy. Let me just finish, and then we'll open up for questions. But I think your question is that actually anticipating the ending here, right? So where are we in the life cycle of myth today? Our situation in our culture. What best describes the state of our religious and moral development today?
Chaos.
We're at the end of the cycle. We are at the trough of development. Living in a time when the old adaptation is coming to an end and the response of the psyche to new developments is still murky at best and hard to describe. Edinger describes the situation very well and relates an important dream, which I think illustrates our dilemma perfectly. Are you familiar with the work of Edward Edinger? Okay, well, this is my favorite book, The Creation of Consciousness, Jung's Myth for Modern Man. Edinger writes, "It is the loss of our containing myth that is the root cause of our current individual and social distress, and nothing less than the discovery of a new central myth will solve the problem for the individual and for society. Indeed, a new myth is in the making, and C.G. Jung was keenly aware of that fact. A Jungian analyst once had the following dream." And, you know, Joan Blattner told me this is Edinger's dream. Right? A temple of vast dimensions was in the process of being built. As far as I could see, ahead, behind, right, left, there were incredible numbers of people building on gigantic pillars. I, too, was building on a pillar. The whole building process was in its very beginning, but the foundations were already there, and the rest of the building was starting to go up, and I and many others were working on it. Jung was told this dream, and his remark was, "Yes, you know, that is the temple we all built on. We don't know the people because, believe me, they build it in India and in China and in Russia and all over the world. That is the new religion. You know how long it will take until it is built? About 600 years. And with that, I think we see the development of personal myth in its full context. At the bottom of the trough, during a time of the failure of the predominant cultural myths to adequately express developments within the human psyche, there are those who keenly feel the loss of meaning and a life purpose. They feel it because no matter how hard they may try to embrace the old story, for them at least it has lost its libido. It is no longer a living symbol, a living myth. Faced with this dilemma, they have no choice but to leave the safe confines of a traditional way of life and wander the wilderness on their own, making their way through life as best they can. If they embrace this forced individuation, something happens. Their own unconscious takes the lead and may provide them with deeply personal and unique rituals, stories, and symbols that come to them in dreams, fantasies, meditation, and creative work. Over a period of time, perhaps a lifetime, this symbolic life may coalesce into a sustainable, energy-enhancing lifestyle and work, the opus, that provides meaning and purpose and satisfies at last the restless unlonging which compelled them on the path of individuation in the first place. They have created and lived a personal myth that is vital to their own psychological well-being and health. Thank you very much for your kind attention. So we just start with questions?
Yeah.
Okay.
What about that picture? You stop.
It isn't stock.
No, I said you stop. What about that photo? Is that you?
Yeah. Sailing into unknown ocean depths? I don't know. It seemed apropos.
I thought you said you were a mountain man.
I am, so it's really strange. Do you know that Emily Dickinson poem about the first league out to sea, right? The joy of a land lover for the first... I wish I could quote it.
Yeah,
my favorite poem, and I'm definitely that. Yeah, West Virginians on sailboats don't go very well together, as my buddies explained to me and cursed at me and all the things that happened, but I learned a little bit. And I still like to go, but it's a great life lesson. Sailing is a wonderful life lesson because it helps when you're, you know, we're at sea. I don't know if I even sailed on a lake, but at sea, you realize an inch of fire glass is the only thing between you and death.
But you still identify as a mountain man.
I do. Call that talk funny?
That's not reason enough.
I identify with Appalachian values.
Mm-hmm.
Yes?
So, kind of a question about the idea of the personal myth. If we've seen that person relating to the collective unconscious without that container of culture,
ends up in McLean Hospital.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking. And
or Bukowski.
And how does that, how did that get prevented in this work you're talking about, personal myths and finding meaning from the psychotic processes going on without going nuts. Is it about finding other kind of containers? It seems like an awfully interesting thing.
Yeah, that's a really, and I don't know how to really fully answer that question. I mean, insofar as I work in the mental health profession, and I used to work at the halfway house associated with McLean Hospital with psychotic patients, and I mean, I experienced, you know, that the psychotic diseases, and let's say schizophrenia, but it includes bipolar, and actually, you know, major depression and anxiety disorders and things like that. The epidemiology of those diseases is that they are the diseases of young people. And in that sense, they're really sad. I mean, I worked with, you know, these are kids who were a freshman at Harvard, a sophomore at Harvard. They had no indication in any of their teenage years of a psychotic break or, you know, any of the things that you see in psychosis. These are kids who were schizophrenic. No, because the age of onset of schizophrenia is age 18 to 25. And so they would have their first psychotic break, right? And all of the hopes and all of the dreams and everything that was in front of it is gone. I don't know, that's a little too personal for me to think about, but it reminds me of, in the book, I realized I had to get, there's a question of this human potential in individuation, which is a little bit what you're asking, right? Why do some people live within the walls of culture? And you can't say that they're unhappy. You can't say that they're not satisfied, that if they follow the myth, they do what they're told to do, they feel great, right? Other people try as hard as they may to fit in, to do the things. The harder they try to fit in, the worse they feel. So they have to leave. And then as soon as they leave, they start to feel better. So somewhere there's an equation about, I call it the potential of a culture and the potential of the individual. So maybe there's the notion that every culture has a certain quantum of potential, that it can only go so far, right? Every culture. Every individual has a quantum of potential. In most cases, the quantum of the potential of the culture exceeds the potential of the individual. And you would think, being from West Virginia, that would be me. Right? Because the culture exceeded everything that I could possibly have understood, right? But in certain situations, the unique individual potential of that individual exceeds the culture the individual is born into. And that potential is not able to be contained by everything around that individual. And what is that individual supposed to do in that situation? They're going to have to, right. So there's something about why certain individuals can, and I suppose there's a kind of, it helps if you find an analyst who's a little bit validating and says, yeah, okay, your problem is you're just too damn smart for yourself and you need to do some shadow work. Right? Okay. I'm not sure who...
I just want to say in response to your second paragraph there answers the whole thing so beautifully. You know, not everyone can do that.
Yeah, right. I think it describes it, maybe. I'm not sure it answers it, but I was trying to describe... Because, again, I'm really frustrated with it being an intellectual exercise. So I'm trying to describe a practice, right? And a lifestyle that goes somewhere. And that's what a living myth would be.
And I think that the key word there is if they embrace this forced individuation,
yes.
Something happens.
Something happens. And there we are, right? That's back to a validation. At least some person saying, you're being authentic to yourself, and you're not going to find what you're looking for in this culture. And that's okay.
It's more so that somebody who's going into the the concept of consciousness about the cultural container, there's more potential for them, you know, becoming grandiose, becoming, having no way of understanding this one monkey trying to understand this whole big thing.
Exactly. I'm so glad I didn't become grandiose. Yes.
So to just understand that this I guess it's more of a Christian term, dark night of the soul.
Ooh.
Would that possibly be that that break of culture and I don't want to say the beginnings of the individuation process, but that culmination of damn, dark, deep, in the hole, cannot see how to function well in society. Could be the middle of
yes.
the process.
Yeah, and so the dark night of the soul was the question, and is that the dark night of the soul is itself kind of a symbol, an image, right? It lives in literature. It has a long historical tradition. I think it's Hebraic, actually. I think it comes into Christianity from the Hebrew religion. But obviously, it's expressed in every religion. Islam also has the dark night of the soul. But from my perspective now, I would say, at least in the Christian tradition, it's a little bit pejorative, because the idea of the dark night of the soul is that you recover. Right? And I'm saying, what if you don't recover? And what if you need to leave? You don't need to recover, you need to get out of there. You need to leave the religion behind and do something else. But yes, the dark night of the soul expresses the reckless lure of the eternal psyche and the return to the eternal roots, right? Like when you think of shamanism, again, now here's where the cultural way of adapting is different in different cultures and in different environments, right? So a shamanistic tradition, you know, the shaman is the one who has gone crazy. As, you know, the epidemiology of schizophrenia has not changed in the last 10,000 years, as a young person, right? Black Elk Speaks, has anybody ever read Black Elk Speaks, right? I mean, there's a lot of questions about the history and authenticity of that book, but let's leave that aside. We'll say that Black Elk is really Black Elk. His story is a pretty typical shamanic story, in that he had this psychotic episode in the teepee when he was 12 years old, and people were worried he was going to die and what would happen, until the old shaman came and listened to what was going on and said, oh yeah, okay, you're going to be a shaman. Right? Because there was a path, there was a cultural vehicle that says, we take this kind of material and we do this with it. Right? And we listen, and we want to know your visions, and we want to know your stories. Right? And we'll include those in our rituals, and that's how the sun dance happened, and all that, all from shamanic visions. Yes?
Regarding the refugees in Europe, what myth is living there?
The refugees in Europe, yeah, regarding the refugees in Europe, which myth
is living there?
Living them. I think they're in the chaos. I think they're in the interregnum, the time between. I think it's an expression of the old way dying. And there is no new way yet. And they're going to have to do it individually. They're going to have to find their own way. And maybe that doesn't mean perfectly adapting to German culture. Is that what they should do? Become good Germans?
They aren't in chaos. There is no myth that they're in. Is that what you're saying?
No.
What is that?
It's collapse. It's the period in the cycle of collapse. Complete collapse. So, I hope, let's say, that a family, two children, right, walking across Europe, through the Balkans, up to Austria, across to Germany, what are they doing in their tent, if they have a tent, to manage their anxiety, right? To help them feel like it's worth going on, or getting up in the morning, Why not just give up and lay down and die? Right? They could very well be having dreams reaching inside of themselves, and something is would feed them. Maybe some. But again, it's the wreck of the Titanic.
So
most are lost. And as the collapse continues, most are lost. I mean, that's why we can't make it a fun thing to go through this.
But my question to you is, in that lost place, that chaos place, they're not in myth right now. Is that what you're saying?
Yes. By definition, they're not in a cultural myth.
But that doesn't mean they aren't in a cycle of the earth and death of myth.
Yes, in the historical sense, they're within the cycle and living on a daily basis the end of the cycle. Personally, what are they finding in themselves
inside
to keep putting one foot in front of the other, right?
And that's where the new myth is born.
The new myth is born as each psyche is scanning the environment to find something, right?
Or the dream.
From the inside, and it could be a dream, and it could be a psychotic vision in which material breaks through, and then again, if it's functional, then it is convincing, right? A black elk, for instance, speaking, he had a dream of the horse dance, and he saw the dance in his dream, and then he woke up, and he went out and he started doing the dance. Now, he was a Sioux, and he was born before the first white contact of the Sioux, and lived straight through till after Wounded Knee. So he lived through the collapse of his culture, right? And the horse dance comes pretty much at the trough, at the bottom of the collapse. So he had the dream, he saw the horse dance, he got up, he went out of his sleeping, he started doing the horse dance. Other people came, "What are you doing?" "I got a dream, this is the horse dance." And they said, "That looks good, let's do that." And they all started doing the horse dance, right? And then it went to other tribes, and it just sort of spread, right? Because it was satisfying something. Like you, Penny, you have to know what the horse energy and the horse image is. And again, how that fed something in that moment, that I'm, by doing the horse dance, I'm connecting with the horse energy, and it's like, and it's not only for me, other people are through the dance, are feeling that energy, and they need to feel it at that time. It's okay.
These mythological eras have been given names. For example, the Piscean. I assume that's the one that's in collapse and moving into the so-called Aquarian age. I'm not sure where these names have come from, but there must be some kind of
idea
of what we're moving into. if it's the Aquarian age, what do you think of this?
So, my thesis at the Jung Institute in Boston ended up being on the psychology of time. So, Joan Blackmer was my thesis advisor. I picked Joan, and so I went in and "Steve, you know, what do you want to do your work on?" I said, "I'm very interested in the psychology of time. That's what I'd like to write my thesis." She said, "Good, that's a good idea. You know, what about time?" I said, "Well, you know, all of time." And there I was on page 623, time, the early years. She said, "Steve, you gotta stop! Take this little section here, it's the Babylonian New Year's Festival. That's it, that's the thesis, that's what it's gonna be." So I have all this material that didn't end up in the thesis. And to answer your question, which was about where does this myth of the Platonic months come from, conflated with the precessional ages, which is, this is the argument in Jung's book, I Am. And I can't take the next week to explain it to you, because it's a little complicated. But essentially, right, Plato talked about the universal months. And in Plato, this is all in Joseph Campbell, a Platonic year is 24,000 years. Each Platonic month is 2,000 years. The idea of the great year, that's what it's called, is in sort of all religious myths. In Hinduism, you know, it's the Kali Yuga, you know, so there's the golden era, there's four eras leading to the Kali Yuga, which is the end of the cycle, which is the bad one, right? And that's where we are now, right? We're at the end of the cycle. So, but expressed in really mathematical images, you know, of time that we can't understand. So there's that. That's a mythological tradition, 6,000 years old, but different fantasies of time, right? Then there's an astronomical fact that has to do with the precession of the equinoxes, which has to do with where the sun is on the vernal equinox. And because of where the sun is, it's where the stars are too. For instance, I was born on June 11th. What does that make me?
Gemini.
Makes me a Gemini, right? Why does it make me a Gemini? Why? As, or you, why? No, there's a reason, right? The sun sign, right? What does that mean? Your sun sign. This is basic Babylonian astrology, going back to the New Year, you know, my expertise in the Babylonian religion. No, the sun sign means right. That the sun was rising on the vernal equinox in Gemini on my birthday. Sorry. What is on the vernal equinox? What is that called in the Babylonian calendar? Which all of us call the astrological calendar, but it's actually the Babylonian calendar. It's called 00 Aries, right? What does that mean? March 21st is 00 Aries in the Babylonian calendar, which means the sun sign, it means that the sun is rising in the first degree of Aries on the vernal equinox. Or, in the case by June 11th, the sun is rising in Gemini, right? If you go up and you look in the east, off one, you don't have hills here, you have, what do you call them?
Hills.
Okay. You don't call them mountains around here? All right. You go and you look to the east. Is the sun in Aries on March 21st? When you go look, you can see where Aries is, you can see where the sun is. No, it's not. Why is that? Where is the sun? For the last 2,000 years, it's been in Pisces.
That's right.
And now it is exiting Pisces. And it's beginning to rise on March 21st. Somewhere in the beginnings of the constellation of Aquarius. And that is an astronomical fact of which is the result of the nutation of the Earth. The Earth wobbles on its axis, which means that's the reason the polar star changes and the reason that the precession of the equinoxes. The sun appears to rise earlier and earlier, but only appears to. And there's only one person who knew, even though the Greeks documented that they were getting off by, I think it's 0.2 something degrees every 100 years. Because it takes 26,000 years for the precession to go all the way through. Sir Isaac Newton was the first person on the planet to discover the nutation of the planet Earth. And could explain the precession of the equinoxes. So, by combining this scientific tradition with a long historical tradition of the great year, somebody somewhere, and it may have been Isaac Newton himself, because he wrote books of prophecy, especially the Book of Daniel, which he was very interested in, right? And having just discovered this wonderful thing called the nutation of the Earth, and having the mathematical calculations to know exactly how this stuff would move, there are how many ages in the book of Daniel? The same four ages, of which we know there is gold, and there is silver, and there is bronze, and there is lead. And which one are we in?
Lead.
Does that all sound familiar? So, I mean, there's, you know, this is the collective unconscious. But this idea, Jung is saying, it's expressing the idea. And this is how this looks over a period of each 2,000 years. That's why I put it that way. With the sort of scientific side on one half cycle and the religious on the other half cycle. What am I trying to say? Did I get the right thing? That's the one I'm looking for. If we do it scientifically, we would not worry about the age of Aquarius. But we could say that the human brain is evolving, and that each new situation may in fact require a psychological adaptation to live in that situation, because the demands of living in that situation are really different than another situation. So I put this together as sort of, you can think of it as population size and human social traits creating these evolutionary selection pressures, and it looks like that.
Overall, Steve, I feel like what I'm trying to grapple with as you're talking is levels of myth or intertwining of cultural myth of aeons. You know, I feel, but then there's the personal myth. Which, when, as I go through these cycles, I have to come into the collective unconscious, which will guide me through those. We don't have to go psychotic, but we do have to find a relationship to the inner and
outer.
And a myth in Babylonian times might really speak to me, because there are cycles of archetypes and myth. Right.
And I would say that the Babylonian myth may speak to you now, as long as it's not an intellectual exercise. Active magic. Or I was thinking in the Shinto thing that I was doing, it isn't that I'm a Buddhist. I mean, if I'm not a Christian, it also means I'm not a Buddhist and I'm not a Hinduist, right? Mm-hmm. But there's the Shinto tradition that is completely foreign to me and has no libido exactly, except all of a sudden it did have libido.
Right?
Right?
Your ancestors as well.
My ancestors, being 8th generation West Virginian, by the way, are probably kind of Welsh, because there's lots of mountains in Wales and they like mountains. We had a question in the back that I wanted to. We had several questions in the back. Okay. Oh, you've been waiting a while. Good.
You know, one thing we haven't mentioned, but it's really significant, is the function of the self to reformulate or reconstruct. I mean, you know, you have the problem. This is the Red Book. You know, you have order and organization and meaning, and now you have chaos. And of course, chaos is threatening because we like order and uncertainty and its security. And it takes the self to help reconfigure. This is part of what Jung found in his confrontation with the unconscious. Okay? So, you know, I mean, that's a healing thought to me, and I think it became so for Jung and gave direction, because if there is a part of the psyche that wants to reconfigure, that will find a way for the migrant.
The matrix of mythopoetic imagination.
Yeah, and it will come to an individual who will embark on that.
Who will embark. Again, just so it's not a field trip.
No, I mean, you're dealing with chaos.
It's
not a field
force, right? It overwhelms you. As it did Jung. I mean, that's the great example.
Chaos is right.
That it overcame him. He didn't know what to do with it. He had spent enough time in their cold sleep to know that, you know, when people start having fantasies like this, it generally means they're going psychotic. Oh. And he writes in chapter 6, Confrontation with the Unconscious, I decided to document my fantasies as long as I still had a mind, so that at least there would be a record of a man who once had these thoughts. Right? That's what he writes. And this, I decided to document my descent, that's the Red Book. I mean, that's what it was, first the Black Book, by the way, and then it was transcribed.
But part of what gave you meaning was that this could help other people. I wasn't doing it alone. He said I was also doing it for how it might help other people, my patients, other people that
I would in the future. My understanding is that he had no idea that his fantasies that he wrote down in the Black Book, which were transcribed in artistic fashion to the Red Book, would help other people. No, he was writing them down so that there would be a scientific record of what it's like when somebody gets psychotic. But only in that way. It was only after he experienced the healing that you're talking about, and the wholeness after, which is starting around 1917, 1918, when he's doing his war duty and he's on the camp on the border, right?
Yeah.
Drawing his mandalas, that he begins, now he starts to feel the healing. And then, having been through the process, from the collapse to the psychosis to the reordering and mandala-like images, that he realized, yes, he could share that with other people. But I think he went through it not thinking about other people.
He said that gave him some of the courage.
After he had been through it and survived it,
I'm not sure that's
there's right. A passage in Mysterium, Conjunctionis, a beautifully written, who says Jung is not a novelist? I mean, I find a lot of these quotes very poetic and, you know, really well written, and I don't know what it is in the German, but he has a passage in Mysterium that talks about only one who has faced the dragon has earned this, the psychic pistis, he uses the Latin word for faith, to have confidence that in the future he can face all future crises. And he's talking about himself very much, you know, that he felt that having been through what looked like a psychotic episode and come out the other side, if I can go through that, I can go through anything. Okay. And there was one doctor. Yes.
It's a simple question. Is following.
Yes.
After Christ, interested in the connection between individuation and its expression of the human being, birth of the birth of the individual. And you also
refer
to the Christian myth of Christ. You wrote in one of your quotes.
Yes. 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 That's an excellent, excellent. There's a tradition in Christianity which is actually a quote from Paul, I believe, in Romans, that Christ is the first seed of the new human. Right? And that is actually a mythological thought that is found in, I mean, so is the Buddha. I mean, and that's the father of the Buddha. But then he's the progenitor. He's the one who has gone before us. And we will all go where he is. So he's the first. And there had to be a first. But the same thing is said about the prophet. The same thing is said about the Buddha. And it's true. Because there is a change in the psyche. So in the history of religions, there was a period, what Jung is talking about, when we won't call it the classical religions, it's actually the late Bronze Age religions, which are the male-dominated, you know, Marduk and Tiamat in Babylon, and back when ancient Israel had a temple, and, you know, the religious practice was you know, temples, and it was a pyramid system with the king at the top, right? I mean, that was the whole, that was the myth, that was the structure. And it was completely collective. There was only one individual. You understand? The king. You participated, you were saved, or as long, because you were of the people. As long as you were a Babylonian, you were okay. As long as you're a Roman, you're okay, right? There isn't anything you had to do, you individually as a person had to do, except to be a Roman. Something changed in the environment. And to me, it is the birth of the classical city-state. In other words, Rome, the first city of a million people on the planet. And to me, there was an evolutionary step in the human brain that is still there today, that we see today. What's the last thing that happens in your brain development when you're 20 or 21? According to the way we see it now, I know there are others later, and we'll discover them. But right now, right.
Yeah, frontal.
And what happens? What ability do you suddenly gain that you didn't have before? Impulse control. Right? Impulse control is the last thing that happens, which you certainly know living here. Or you see lots of young people with no impulse control, but they don't have it. They have their brain, it hasn't switched on yet, that part, right? When you live in a city of a million people, all of a sudden, you can't kill the Jews because you're living in the same city with them. You can't kill the damn Babylonians because you're living in the same city with them. You can't have all this intra-fighting of these desperate cultures back from the Bronze and Iron Age way of doing things, right? Because now we're a polis. I mean, now Rome is Rome. How are you going to do that? I have to kill you, right? You're a Parthian. Right? You have to develop impulse control. And it's an evolutionary thing. The people who didn't develop impulse control are dead. They didn't pass along their genes. The people who did, and that part of the brain evolved. So all of the religions of this era share an interesting quality, and that is, it starts with Buddhism in 500 BC and it extends through Islam in 700 AD. The religions of this era share a common factor. There is an individual, right, who had a revelation. So it's really not quite like Moses. I mean, it's not, that's again more collective, because that's all the statement of a late Bronze Age religion. This new religion is an individual who has a revelation, whether it's the Buddha or Christ or the prophet, right? And then teaches, and then you do not have to ethnically be in that group. But you have personal responsibility, right, for what you do. If you're a Christian, or if you're a Buddhist, and it emphasizes the light. All of the religions of that era emphasize the light and to avoid and to shun the darkness, which is what impulse control is all about, right? Be people of the light. Don't be people of the dark. That's impulse control. When you're on a dark street in a back alley in Rome, you hope for damn sure that the guy walking next to you has impulse control and is a person of the light. Right? Not of the darkness. But Jung is talking about, again, every evolutionary stage brings its own problems. We have put the darkness into the shadow. And how did that work out? We were people of the light, but boy, we know how to gas them in the chambers. We people of the light. They were all Christians who did this, and it doesn't matter. Fundamentalist Buddhists have killed more people than anybody else, right? Pretty much. Japan in World War II, and what they did to China, and what they did to Korea. Those are Shinto people. Those are Buddhists. Fundamentalist Buddhists, but they killed a lot of people, those fundamentalist Buddhists. And fundamentalist Hindus are killing a lot of people today. And so it isn't just fundamentalist, it's the fundamentalist.
right? Woman has had her hand up.
Yes, ma'am.
Yes. I want to propose a model out of general systems theory.
Yes.
Okay. The model, you showed the bell curve. Okay. I want to propose that when you come to the top of the bell curve, and that's maturation, and everything is going along swimmingly, and you're doing great, what you know when you're at the top is that what's ahead is the slippery slope, and you're going to go down. So, if instead of following that curve down, which is predictable, if at that point you transform either by flipping up or flipping out, which is another way of flipping up,
yep.
And you transform and start a new up of the bell, a new bell curve.
Self-organizing systems.
Yes.
That's what you're talking about. Yes. So this is a good question, right? So there's she's proposing a theory of what if some very smart leader could see where the culture was in the cycle, right? And at the very top of peak functionality could, instead of being a fundamentalist and holding on to the old, no matter how out of touch with the actual situation it has become, which destroys everything, could instead, by being such a wise leader, flip, jump, have an evolutionary leap,
it's a transformation.
Which is called the principle of self-organizing systems, right? Which happens, this is chaos theory, and in chaos theory, obviously, you have everything runs down, right? Third law of psychodynamics, right? Entropy. It's the second law, third law. I'm a religion major. Entropy, right? All systems have entropy, that's what our bell curve is too, right? All systems have, but occasionally, very occasionally, there are these situations like a laser. The laser that all of you have that reads your credit cards and the laser. Light instead of being distorted and jumping around, jumps to a different level of organization and all of a sudden falls in this incredible order. I mean, that's the laser is an amazing thing, and how you get light to do that. I'm not a scientist, but it is an example of the self-organizing principle. But I would say, in your theory, in chaos theory, the only thing that creates the circumstances where a laser can develop, and then there are certain forms of slime mold, there are several examples in the nature of these self-organizing systems. It only happens at the bottom of the trough. It happens in the complete disintegration of everything, that at a certain moment comes, what does Kurzweil call it? The singularity. The singularity. Have you heard of the singularity?
Yeah.
Yeah.
But if, as you were describing, someone is going along, they're up at the top of the bell curve, and they are seeing everything around them, and they say, this is bullshit. Doesn't everybody notice? This doesn't work. It doesn't work for me. I'm flipping out of this. And I am, when things seem to be going well, I'm going to start something new. In that way, the thing keeps cycling up and up and up. And you can be crazy or you can be a genius. Either way, you're going to flip out by transforming the status quo.
Yes.
I had a dark thought that if you do that to the others at the top will kill you.
Yes.
But I don't mean that.
The system reacts.
Yeah.
When you are outside of the system, the system has a vested interest in making sure you don't flip out.
Yeah.
Because you're a threat.
And what the system is going to do is what it wants to do, which is go down. But you're going to start a new bell curve by going, by starting up. But it's on a different level.
It could be, but let's put it this way. If you do it in your own practice, you still have to be the refugee who could die tomorrow trying to get through the barbed wire in Hungary. I mean, the decline of the system affects everybody who's at the end of the curve. Whether you're smart or not smart, you're still having to go through barbed wire. Yes, there. One last
One of the responses I'm having to your presentation is what seems to me to be an enormous tension, if not a conflict, between the process and experience of individuation and cultural, religious, or mythological
models.
And that feels like too much of an either or to me. I go to the congregational church that I used to serve in Amherst, and it is a radically different community and a radically different type of religious ritual and service than when I was pastor for 9 years from 1953 to 1962.
Right.
There has been an
evolution
and individuation of a cultural norm or a cultural experience. To me, I feel that my experience with the Jungian wisdom and the Jungian insights
and the Jungian myth
has been transformative for me, but I don't feel that my individuation has taken me out of my Christian roots. My father was a minister. My grandfathers were ministers. I'm a very different kind of minister, partly because I fought in the combat in the Second World War and liberated a concentration camp. I didn't go through the dark side.
Right.
And so I just want to say a word on behalf of the transformative continuing power of religious experience when it is experience and not dogma. That's a critical
issue. Right. So I would just finish up with, in the 25 years since I've tried to become a little more nuanced in what culture is and what myth is. And in fact, the statement we read from MDR when you says, do we live in a myth anymore? Apparently we no longer live in a myth. It's not, of course, actually true. I mean, you can go outside of the walls of culture, but what time is it? 9 o'clock. Why is it 9 o'clock? Yes, and that's kind of a myth, right? But it's not only that. How many, it's 9 o'clock, because how many minutes are in an hour? Why? What? Well, you could say, but I mean, it could be 100 heartbeats. I mean, you can pick any figure you want. And in general, we live in a decibel system, right? Why are there 60?
It works.
No, that's not it. Because it's the Babylonian number system, which is a sexagesimal notation based on the number 60. And here we are, the Babylonian that lives today, and we use it every time we ask what time it is. It's the old Babylonian myth is still here. It hasn't gone anywhere.
The Babylonian myth works.
Thank you very much.